is it really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Monday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand in the Allstate Skyline Studio on this President's Day. If you're not typically at home listening to the radio or out listening to the radio, we certainly welcome you to the Biz Lunch on this Monday. A little bit later, we'll talk to Elise Glink, and I mentioned with Bill and Wendy, one of the questions I want to talk to her about is the growing number of underinsured people in the country. We were fighting to get more and more people insured under the Affordable Care Act, and that certainly has happened. More and more people are insured, but the number of underinsured has been going up as well. I'm not sure how you fix that, but we'll talk to Elise Glink about that. Also, selling homes in the Chicago area, the bidding wars that were really more predominant around other parts of the country, but even there, the bidding wars for homes are slowing down as it looks like the housing market is slowing a bit. But we start on Mondays with the folks from Chicago Inno, and Jim Dahlke joins us on a phone line today as their offices are closed for the holidays. So, Jim, welcome, and I appreciate you spending part of your day off with us. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Happy Monday.
Who's your favorite president?
Oh, boy. I mean, there's just so many good ones to choose from.
Well, you know, what I was thinking today is, wouldn't it be kind of cool? Well, it would be cool to be George W. or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. You know, on what do they do on President's Day? It's like, yeah, honey, can't do it. It's my day. It's President's Day.
Yeah, it's like an extra Father's Day.
Right. I think you get a little bonus. Birthday, Father's Day, it's President's Day. Not many of us can do that, but a few of us can. Before we get too far into some of the stuff that's going on this week, I want to go back to the whole Amazon thing with you, because you said early on that this was, in a way, not a ruse or a scam on Amazon's part, but you certainly were dubious about the whole thing. And now that they've decided to withdraw from New York, I just wonder what you make about that.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable the way that this whole thing has kind of worked itself out, right? I mean, it began, you know, at the end of 2017 is really kind of, you know, the most interesting or biggest business story in decades. You know, had the opportunity to kind of totally transform and revitalize a city's economy, or at very least its tech economy. And sort of the way it sort of has worked out is, you know, it kind of chose the two most obvious cities in D.C. and New York, and then now one of those cities actually doesn't even want it all together. So the way this has kind of fizzled out has been pretty amazing to watch. And so now what you're seeing is Amazon sort of scrambled to disperse these jobs anywhere they can. And what they say is, you know, they're going to put these jobs in their 17 corporate offices. So even though you're seeing Chicago and Illinois officials say, hey, HQ2, we're still here, and you're seeing folks in New Jersey and even in Nashville say, hey, come on, we want to have some more of these jobs. What we're seeing is basically Amazon is throwing in the towel on what was originally, you know, HQ for one city, and now it's not even HQ for two cities.
So you think this is kind of a face plant for Amazon?
I think so. I think what we saw here is that Amazon did not get the red carpet that it had assumed that it would get, right? And I think what's interesting about this to me is that if Amazon did this maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, things might have played out a little differently. What you're seeing is just general public opinion around quote-unquote big tech has changed a lot in the last couple years, whether it's, you know, Facebook's privacy issues, everything from, you know, the surveillance to automation of jobs. I think people just generally are a little more wary of big tech than they have been in recent years. So what kind of started as, you know, everybody wanting Amazon, you know, as these last few years have gone on, people have started to get a little more cautious about how they kind of approach, you know, these big tech giants. And Amazon didn't quite get the rollout that it was expecting. So pretty fascinating to see, you know, kind of how this has played out. Obviously, it's not that big of a deal, right, for New York, a city the size of New York City, to lose, you know, a potential 25,000 jobs. Now, had Amazon picked Pittsburgh or Columbus or some one of these kind of smaller tier cities, you know, the pullout of you know, dozens of tech jobs is certainly significant, less so now because of New York.
But I don't think we know everything yet, because it just it doesn't make sense to me, if you were going to make this big dive in, that, you know, you'd be so quickly to run with your tail between your legs. I mean, I said last week, Bezos certainly shows he's up for a fight. If they thought this was a good idea and the best thing for them, I don't understand why some rhetoric from left-wing politicians sort of scared them out of fighting for their development.
It is very confusing. And to me, you know, if Amazon says, hey, we truly need a second headquarters. I mean, that was the idea of the whole HQ2 concept, right? Like, we need a Seattle-level office somewhere else in the country based on what we're doing as a company and the demand for jobs and with the kind of things we're building, right? So what they did was they said, actually, you know what? We can't do it in one place. We'll do it in two places, which was still kind of a head-scratcher. And now, at this point, they're saying we're going to scrap it all together, right? So if you really truly needed a full new headquarters, and now you're just going to throw these jobs across all your corporate offices, you do have to wonder, like, how much did they really need it in the first place, and what was sort of their intention from the beginning?
And some of those jobs will come to Chicago, presumably, right?
That's correct. So Amazon has 17 corporate offices across the U.S., and they have said that they will kind of disperse those 25,000 HQ2 jobs among the cities, and Chicago was one of those. So Chicago has about 300 or so corporate Amazon employees currently kind of working on its advertising and Amazon Web Services offices. So you can expect those to grow based on kind of their plans to continue to distribute some of those jobs.
All right, that's one giant. The other giant that made news last week anyway was Google when they talked about making Chicago a finance hub for the company. But Catherine Davis wrote this story in Chicago Inno, which I don't know, it didn't surprise me, I guess. I hadn't thought of it. But Google says that their economic activity in Illinois, it topped $1 billion, helping 48,000 state businesses. That's a pretty big impact.
It is, and it's going to continue to grow. So the news that they made last week, Google did, was that they're going to continue to add hundreds of jobs to their Chicago office. They currently have about 1,000 folks in the West Loop. They're going to lease another building out in that area and, continue to add to Chicago. So they're going to make the city a bit of a finance hub for the company. So they're going to be adding some finance jobs in Chicago, and potentially they could be doubling the size of their Chicago office within the year. So really up to 2,000 folks here in Chicago based on some early hiring stuff. So it's interesting. Google is a really interesting tech story for Chicago because, you know, it kind of started as a small sales team, just a handful of folks kind of working for Google here in a sales capacity. And really it has grown to house a lot of different jobs. So a lot of engineering jobs, there's some hardware development happening here in Chicago, which really was kind of unthinkable, you know, 10 years ago. So it's cool to see Chicago not just be a place for, Google's advertising folks, but some real high-tech jobs as well.
So how are we doing? I mean, we didn't get HQ2. Okay, we're going to pick up a few jobs there. Google is here in force. Salesforce certainly is here in force. So, I mean, I think as Rahm Emanuel looks back on his second term in office, I think the numbers in the tech world have certainly grown.
I think so. And a part of this, too, is that, you know, the Chicago startups are breathing a little bit of a sigh of a relief in the short term because they don't have to compete with Amazon in terms of 25,000 jobs for hiring, right? So the one issue, if there is a concern for Chicago's tech ecosystem, is in the short term that hiring could be a little more challenging. So Chicago's startups will still be able to kind of hire the talent that they need and not have to worry that they've got some tech giant in town that's still hiring,
actually,
you know, dozens.
I was going to say my only shot at actually getting an engineering job was if Amazon had come here and hired all the real engineers. So I lose out a little bit. Hey, let's go. I'm sorry, Jim, but let's go downstate a little bit while we wrap up this first segment. And Rivian, now I know Steve Grzanich on the opening bell is going to talk to an executive at Rivian tomorrow morning, so I'll tune in for that. But this is this company. They're making electric trucks. They moved into the Mitsubishi plant in Bloomington Normal, and they're picking up funding, right? This is a company that's on the move.
Yeah, speaking of Amazon just led a $700 million funding round in this new startup, Rivian. So Rivian is based in Michigan, but they have a $2.6 million plant, like you said, down in Normal, and they will be making these electric trucks and SUVs downstate. So pretty interesting to kind of see the energy around this new kind of transportation innovation happening just within the state. So, you know, really think about what Tesla has kind of done for the sedan. Rivian is really doing kind of for off-road vehicles. And the trucks look pretty sharp. So they are going to start making those soon. And the company's accepting pre-orders and going to roll these out starting in 2020.
And they're talking about 1,000 jobs in Normal by the year 2024, which is a big number for an area that size. And Amazon is involved in this because this is how we're going to get our packages one day?
Yeah, I mean, Amazon is putting a lot of investment just really around kind of different innovations in its logistics, right? So thinking about how it can use different methods to continue to deliver, you know, your Amazon Prime packages to your door. So one could imagine that, you know, they could use a fleet of Rivian trucks as part of their delivery fleet. So don't expect Amazon to continue to make different kinds of investments around all kinds of logistics innovation.
Okay, Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Thanks very much for tuning in. I went to a great restaurant over the weekend. I think it was called Make Room for Truman, which is an odd thing, but it was in Park Ridge, and it just got me thinking about that. I'm not sure exactly what clicked it, but this company, Second Kitchen. Now, Make Room for Truman, that's a restaurant on their own. Second Kitchen is this startup, right, Jim, that Jim Dahlke's on the phone line from Chicago Inno, that works with, I don't know, taverns or other social clubs or places like that that don't have a kitchen or don't have a restaurant. They try to marry restaurants to the bar, correct?
That's right. So what Second Kitchen is able to do is kind of create custom food menus for these kitchenless bars and breweries and other establishments based on restaurants that are nearby. So they're kind of able to create a delivery system and a unique food offering for these businesses that previously weren't able to do this. So And they just raised a little bit of funding last week, $1.35 million. And always kind of interesting to see, you know, a company that gets funding who will also, I just kind of like love the business idea. Like, I have no idea if Second Kitchen's going to be the next greatest startup in Chicago, right? But they are solving an interesting pain point, at least that I've noticed in my own life. You know, you go to a brewery and you're like, wow, this brewery is great, but boy, I really could use a cheeseburger. And so basically what they're able to do is kind of provide that kind of meal delivery for restaurants.
And so the bar,
I really think that they're finding an interesting niche.
So the bar, if it's in the bar, you could either order from the bar or there might be a kiosk there, and they partner with a specific restaurant nearby. And the bar doesn't pay anything for it because they're an opportunity for the restaurant to sell more cheeseburgers, I guess. I mean, would the restaurant worry that people might be going to their joint for cheeseburgers but instead are buying their booze at the bar?
Well, you know, I think for the restaurant, you know, they're opening up another revenue stream, right? So that didn't exist before. So it's not like, you know, they're taking money one way or the other, right? So I think what the restaurant likes is that they have an additional avenue to make a sale. What we can do too is, like, if you're at a brewery and you leave the brewery, you could go anywhere, right, to go get a little bite to eat. But what the restaurant gains is by getting its kind of food options directly in front of you right while you're at the brewery. So I think the restaurant likes it in the sense of they're getting their menu right to the folks who want it.
It's called Second Kitchen, and it's up and running, right, in some spots now?
Yeah, they're working with a couple places in Chicago, the Map Room, Hopewell Brewing, and Off Color Brewing.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Brewers Brewing clearly being the big one there.
Well, that's the tap room thing, right? We've talked about tap rooms where you just sell your beer and nothing else, so this is a good fit for them. You have a nice piece about M-Hub and manufacturing in Chicago, where you look together at the 12 different Chicago manufacturing companies, makers to watch, and they come out of M-Hub. Now, we talk a lot about 1871, and we've talked about Matter, which does healthcare startups, but M-Hub maybe doesn't always get enough credit for the influence it's having in Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago hasn't. It's interesting, right? You don't think of Chicago as kind of this, like, hub for hardware necessarily. Obviously, the Bay Area and Silicon Valley kind of own a lot of the hardware that's really been a consumer hit. But Chicago's really making lots of strides. And, you know, Chicago has a storied history in hardware innovation, whether it's, you know, Motorola's launch here and kind of the very first cell phones. There's a lot of history when it comes to hardware. And there's a lot of up-and-coming startups who are doing a lot of interesting things, too. And M-Hub, which officially launched just 2 years ago, was really able to provide not just a roof and walls for these entrepreneurs to work and desk space, but a lot of the machinery, the CNC, the laser cutting, a lot of these, you know, 3D printing, a lot of the, you know, expensive heavy-duty machinery that these entrepreneurs need to make their prototypes and to kind of get their products off the ground. So M-Hub was able to fill a really interesting gap for Chicago's entrepreneurs.
Okay, so you listed 12 to watch, and, you know, we've talked about some of them. We've talked about Tovala before, but I want you to just give me a little rundown on some of the others. Like, what's Pepper?
Yeah, Pepper is a really interesting one. So it's a consumer hardware device for your kitchen, and basically it's a smart scale. So it has some sensors in it, and it basically, one thing it'll do, it allows you to ditch your measuring cup. So you kind of put a bowl on top of the scale, and if you need, you know, a a couple ounces of oil, you put it on there, and you know it right off the bat without having to actually use any measuring cups. And it's also got built-in Alexa, so you can do voice controls as well. And it has a video player that shows you step-by-step instructions on how to cook different items. So really kind of all-in-one there.
All right, Winston Privacy, what's that?
Yeah, Winston Privacy is a startup that we've talked about a little bit before, and they have created kind of a hardware solution for online privacy.
Okay, so right. That's what I was wondering. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, that's what I thought it might have been. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it plugs into your cable modem and your wireless router, and it basically is able to keep you from being hacked and tracked. Gets your internet running faster because it reduces ads. So basically, it's just an online kind of physical device, sits in your living room, and kind of keeps you safe from the digital bad guys.
I can't believe, Jim, that I forgot the name of the company, because I think when we first talked about that, I said it was going to change the course of the world. Are they doing pretty well?
So far, so good. So they just rolled out their product last year, so it's still pretty early stage. We talked to the founders not too long ago. It looks like they're out raising some more money. So, expect Winston Privacy to be making some more moves here before too long.
All right, real quick, one more. Amber Agriculture. What is Amber Agriculture making?
So Amber Agriculture has a really neat little sensor. So basically what they're able to do is they've created this sensor. It's about the size of a little bit bigger than a quarter. It's really interesting. And farmers can throw it into their grain bins and their silos, and it measures different things in their grains, like moisture content and humidity and kind of mold detection. And it allows farmers to capture the highest possible price point per bushel based on kind of like very specific details about the weight of their grain. Launched this product out of the University of Illinois, and the founders, they have an interesting story. They initially built a device to throw in their dryer to tell when their clothes were actually dry.
I love that.
They were able to take that and actually like turn it into a real business.
And certainly much more needed in the agriculture business than it is in the laundromat. Jim Dahlke, read more at chicagoino.com. Thanks for joining us today. And again, on your day off, I appreciate it. Now go study up your list of presidents.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. It's 12:36 here in Chicago. Elise Glink will be here a little bit later to talk about, well, I want to talk to her about the insurance for those of us in this country. You know, more and more of us are insured, but apparently, I didn't realize this, more and more of us are underinsured. So while the number of insured goes up, the number of people who are sort of hampered by the insurance they do have has been increasing as well. But before that, let's head to Mars. Dr. Tanya Harrison is on the phone line, planetary scientist and director at Arizona State University's Space Technology and Science Initiative, but a lot more than that as well. Tanya, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
You were on one of the original teams for the Opportunity rover, is that correct?
Yes, I was on the team for the panchromatic cameras, or the pan cams, basically the color eyes of the rover.
Okay, and I want to talk to you because, first of all, I'll tell you, I'm not a big space guy, so you're going to have to speak slowly for me and explain it all. But I've never witnessed something where the end of a machine was treated so much like a funeral or the loss of a friend. You were there last week, right, when they made the final announcement?
Yes, I was.
Tell me about it.
It was a really emotional moment. You know, a lot of people that work on this mission have been invested in it for significant portions of their careers. You know, the rover was operational for 14 and a half years. It was on Mars for over 15 years. And then you have all of the research and development time and the launch time and the time it takes to get to Mars. So the principal investigator, Steve Squires, for example, spent about 20 years of his career working on this one particular mission. And so it becomes part of your daily life, and to suddenly have that gone is a huge loss.
It almost seems as though as if the rover was personified in a way too, right? Because it was only supposed to be working for 90 days, and it was working for many years, more than expected, and it almost seemed as if this was a living robot.
Yeah, we often refer to the rover as she, and, you know, I think it, because it looks like something that we can kind of relate to, it has eyes, it has an arm, we can picture ourselves in the place of the rover on the surface of Mars, better than we could say trying to emote with a satellite that's orbiting right. the Earth or Mars or something like that. And so it helps you attach to it even more that way.
So was the movie, you know, the movie WALL-E, that robot looked like the Opportunity rover. Was one based on the other? I mean, obviously Opportunity wasn't based on WALL-E, but was WALL-E based on what Opportunity looked like?
I'm not sure if it was intentionally or not, but there's definitely some similarities there.
Right. Okay. So we're done with Opportunity, sadly. She will rest there, apparently under a layer of dust forever. But there is a rover up there now, Curiosity, right, who followed Opportunity?
Right. So Curiosity has been operating on Mars since 2012 and is still going strong and will hopefully last for many more years to come.
What are you getting from Opportunity that you are from Curiosity, rather, that you might not have gotten from Opportunity? Or is it pretty much the same data from a new data collector?
Curiosity has more instruments to give us more specific information. So the goal for Opportunity's mission was to follow the water, to basically tell us about the history of water on Mars. And the goal of Curiosity is specifically to look for signs of habitability, which is basically a way of saying we're looking for clues of what the environment used to be on Mars in terms of the water, the temperature, the atmosphere, the chemistry, to see if they were conducive to life as we know it. And we landed Curiosity. Oh, sorry.
No, you go ahead, please.
So we landed Curiosity in a gigantic crater that's basically the site of an ancient crater lake about 3.5 billion years ago on Mars. And the water in the lake is gone at this point, but it left all this material behind that we're slowly driving up and sampling along the way to get clues about the history of Mars. And what we found is an environment that could have been really great for life as we know it about 3.5 billion years ago.
And so what do we do with that information? So we know that perhaps there may have been life on Mars 3.5 billion years ago. How does that help us today in 2019?
It helps us learn about our context in the solar system and in the universe. It's a really interesting question of if Mars had conditions that could have supported life at a time when Earth also had life, you know, 3.5 billion years ago, there was life on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the life on Mars if it was there? Or if the conditions on Mars were ripe for life to have arisen and it didn't, what happened? Why did it happen on Earth and not on Mars? So answering the question either way is really important.
And there's another one coming up in 2020?
Yes, that one doesn't have a name yet.
Let's work on that, Tanya. What can we do? Let's name it. What can we name it? Go ahead. You know more than me.
Well, there's going to be a contest for kids that starts, I think, this fall to give it a name like we've had with the previous rovers. So if you have any kids that want to try and name the rover, stay tuned, and NASA will have a thing online for you to be able to submit stuff for that.
And it'll launch in 2020, is that correct?
Yeah, it should launch around July of 2020.
And then when does it get to Mars?
It usually takes 6 to 8 months to get there.
Oh, that's just like driving to my mother-in-law's. And so, you know, Curiosity is not going to last forever. Obviously, this new one won't last forever. Do you think that when they go, that there will be the same sort of emotional outpouring that there was for Oppie for the Opportunity?
I think so. I think there'll definitely be a lot of emotional outpouring. I think Opportunity definitely has a special place in all of our hearts just because of how much she went through and how many obstacles she overcame to get to having been on Mars for 15 years when no one would have expected it. So it's kind of like a little underdog. I think maybe if Curiosity lasts like 20 years, you know, then we'll have the same kind right. of emotional reaction.
How do you feel? I mean, where are we when it comes to space exploration? The government is not nearly as involved as it used to be. Private enterprise is doing a lot more. Do you think that's a good thing for your science, or are you disappointed in that for your science?
I think it's a good thing. The commercial sector opens up a lot of opportunity in terms of reducing costs, and they're a lot more agile and willing to take risks than the government can, just because the government is so accountable to the American taxpayer. You know, their risk posture is a lot lower, so they aren't willing to do as many new shiny things as industry can take risks of. You know, Elon Musk can pay how much of his own money to do whatever he wants, essentially, and NASA doesn't quite have that same liberty.
Yeah, what did he say? $500,000 for a ride up? Would you do that?
If I had enough money, I would.
We'll start raising it for you. Dr. Tanya Harrison, planetary scientist, director at Arizona State University Space Technology and Science Initiative. Dr. Harrison, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Great, thank you.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. If you're tuned into the auto world, you know that it's auto show season. And as the Chicago Auto Show wraps up in the city, things are just gearing up out in Normal, Illinois, where the electric manufacturing plant for Rivian Trucks is based. The Michigan-based automaker just secured a $700 million investment, with one of the biggest backers being Amazon. It's been creating a lot of buzz, because the electric leader Tesla has talked a lot about dipping into the electric truck market after they secured themselves in the sedan market. Nearly $750 million is mind-boggling, so needless to say, there will be very high expectations coming from Rivian. And things are moving forward now that we're officially not one of Amazon's favorite cities. There were a number of sites for the online retailer to base their HQ to, and one of them was owned by Tribune Media. Our parent company owns 30 acres of land on the north branch of the river deemed the Freedom Center printing plant, and it will see a change soon as it's up for sale. It's early on in the process, but that's some pretty hot real estate being right on the river, so we'll keep our eyes out for the changes. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. We're going to talk to Elise Glink in just a minute or two. While I have a second, I want to remind you, Sharon and I, my wife Sharon and I, are going to lead a group to Portugal coming up in October. We'll leave on October 19th. It's a 9-day trip. I think this will probably be the last WGN trip of the year, and we're going to just three hotels, which I think a lot of people like. We're going to be in Lisbon for 3 nights. We're going to be in Coimbra for one night, and then 3 nights in Porto. We'll tour a winery, some music, some great fado music, and we have always a good time on these trips. And we're already about a quarter filled just with people who've traveled with me last time. So if you're interested in seeing Portugal, the people there are supposed to be lovely. We'll have group Portuguese lessons on the bus, I promise. You can find more information by emailing me, steve@stevebertrandtravel.com, or at the information at wgnradio.com. It's at stevebertrandtravel.com. Or just give me a call, 847-606-6065. We always have a great time on these trips, and there's room for you to join us in Portugal this October. On the phone line now is Elise Glink behind thinkglink.com, of course, and Best Money Moves, and she travels the country with her different business ventures, and she joins us on a phone line now. Elise, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hey, Steve. Nice to be here.
Okay, so where are you? Where today?
I'm in snowy Denver, which is about 10 degrees, so even colder than Chicago.
Well, we've got that going for us, and I can't argue with that. I was reading a story this week about the healthcare insurance, which struck me as pretty interesting. The healthcare bill, Obamacare, was designed to reduce the number of uninsured people in the country, and I think it's had some success there. I didn't realize that the number of underinsured people, though, is going up. Can you explain that for me?
Sure. So, what we're seeing in corporate America is a shift from sort of employer-paid insurance, which, and it still is, but now it's high-deductible healthcare insurance. And what that's done is shift to employees the first $1,000, $1,500, even as much as $7,500 per family of cost. And for employees, they choose those high-deductible healthcare plans because the premiums are so low.
Right.
But on the other hand, when it comes time and somebody gets sick, they have to dig in deep. And so we're seeing that they're not really getting the coverage that they need, or they're not taking advantage of the medical bills, the medical care that they need because the costs are so high. And so that's part of this underinsurance problem.
So I'm looking at a statistic here. 28% of the U.S. adults who have health insurance through their work were underinsured in 2018, up from 20% just 4 years ago. So that's what we're talking about, right? I thought, well, hey, you've got insurance through your work, then it must be the employers who, in one way or another, are coming up short. But what you're saying is that it's the employees maybe who are opting for the wrong plans.
Right. Well, they're opting for the plans that they can afford, and what it's thinking, well, who's going to think I'm going to get sick or really sick? And then when somebody does, they're caught short. And it's contributing to actually a larger problem, as I focus on with Best Money Moves every week, which is how employees are able to make the most of every single dollar that they earn and that they have to spend. And there's just so much competing for that dollar. And unfortunately, healthcare costs sometimes take a back seat. And that's problematic for the employer because, you know, if you're sick and your kids are sick, right? Winter, everybody gets sick in the family.
Right.
You know, as a parent, you're going to take the kids in. But the employer is worried that you're going to go without yourself. And if you've got a chronic condition, let's say diabetes, and you're not managing it properly, that can cause much more expensive problems down the line that the employer would then be on the hook for. So there's a lot of different things to think through.
So what's the fix then? I mean, is it that we should not make these high deductible plans available or limit them more?
I think it's a lot of education. I think employers are starting to recognize the financial stress that their people are under, and they're starting to look for creative ways to help, which is good. I think educating and helping people understand some of the different options and when a good expense, you know, might be good to spend the money here versus here. I think education's that kind of education is really important as well.
All right, so there's that. There's the healthcare. I also, while I've got you, I want to talk to you a little bit about real estate and about the. It looks to me like the real estate market nationwide is cooling off a little bit. Redfin was out with a number talking about how the number of sales they've got that have become bidding wars. Sales have dropped pretty dramatically in January this year compared to January of 2018. I think it was down 53%. Is that right?
Yeah, it's interesting. We were seeing such a hot market in the fall, right up until, you know, December, basically. And the way you define a hot market is, you know, the number of days that a property stays on the market, right? So you look to those to being low, like maybe 30 or 45 days. That's a super hot market. And then the other part is the number of, bids that you get. And so when you get a multiple bid situation, many people bidding on something, it bids the price way up. And we have seen that come down. Now, unfortunately, in Chicago, we weren't seeing all that many bids, but nationally, multiple bidding has really died down.
Right. So in Chicago, the number of bids has dropped relative. If you look at the top 20 markets, it's toward the bottom. But the reason for that is because there probably weren't that many in the beginning, right?
Correct. So you're like in a hot market like Denver, where I am today, you've actually seen it fall quite dramatically, or in San Francisco. And there's a number of reasons for that. Some of it is that interest rates popped up a little bit at the end of the year. They've since come down. But when they pop up, that means that over the next sort of 30 to 60 days, you might see offers drop down because people can't afford the higher interest rate for the properties that they're looking at. And then the other thing that Redfin said, and I think there's some truth to it, is that the spring market's beginning. So more homes are going on the market. People don't feel pressure to make an offer for every last house because there are others that they can go see.
When does that market start in the spring? Because I remember a few years ago someone saying, well, no, it's after the Super Bowl. Once the Super Bowl is over, that's sort of the beginning of the warm-up in the housing market.
You know, that's exactly right. I used to joke that it was January 2nd, but actually it is generally after Super Bowl Sunday. And that's not to say that winter period from Thanksgiving to the Super Bowl, there aren't a lot of home buyers and sellers out there. There are. It's just that the number of homes tends to increase exponentially over the springtime, and then you get the buyers following through. So right now we're seeing more homes in the market than buyers, and so you're seeing the market slow down a little bit.
And so in Chicago, if it slows down a little bit, it has a bigger impact than in, say, San Francisco or Seattle when it slows down because they've been so hot, right?
Yes. Unfortunately for us, we're seeing property prices in a place, particularly on the North Shore and the western side suburban market that we haven't seen in a long time, and not for the better. So you're seeing properties stay in the market a little bit longer, particularly properties priced around $1 million or above.
Mm-hmm.
You're just not seeing the kind of growth and home price appreciation that we would like to see. And you and I have talked about that. There's a number of reasons for it. But what concerns me is that if we are entering a slower spring market, that those prices could fall even further in Chicago.
Tell me about interest rates before we go, because you said they sort of have been coming down a bit. I mean, the interest rates haven't gone up as much as they might have given the Fed's interest rate increases. Am I right there or wrong?
You are. So what happened was last year, we actually every year since you know, 10 years ago, we've heard the mortgage experts talk about how interest rates are going to hit 5%. Well, last year we came the closest we've come. I saw interest rates at around 4.75% briefly. If you sneezed, you might have missed it. And now they've come all the way back down to about, I think it was 4.2 for a 30-year fixed rate loan, which is still pretty low. And
right.
And you're seeing long-term rates come down, but short-term rates go up, and that is one of the signs of a possible recession.
We don't want that. Lee Sklink, enjoy your trip. I hope you have a profitable trip, and we'll talk again next week.
Thanks, Steve.